Well, it's pretty much 10:30, so I think I'm going to start now. To begin with, I'm supposed to tell everyone that if you have a cell phone, you should turn it off. I don't know exactly how long this is going to be. It might go, it'll be under an hour. But if you have any questions, if you could wait till the end, and then we'll have a Q&A period. My name is Mike Rayner. I'm a software engineer from Electronic Arts Canada. I worked on SSX and SSX Tricky. I'm going to talk to you today about the visual engineering of SSX. So for those who might not know about SSX, SSX is a snowboarding game based on the real-life downhill sport of border cross snowboard racing. SSX was a first-generation PlayStation 2 title. Subsequently, last fall, we released SSX Tricky, the sequel, on the PlayStation 2, the GameCube, and the Xbox. I'm going to talk about rendering technologies implemented for SSX on the PlayStation 2. I'm going to briefly go over the PS2 architecture. So just to get a feel for the audience, who here is, you could put up your hand if you're working on a PS2 or you're familiar with the PS2 architecture. Okay, a little over half. Okay, great. So I'm briefly going to go over the PS2. Most of what I'm going to be covering is applicable to other platforms. However, it would be helpful for me to go over the PS2 hardware for those who, may be unfamiliar with it. This talk is not intended to teach you how to write code for the PlayStation 2. There are lots of good references and presentations available on Sony's developer website. The main goal of this presentation is to share with you some of the choices we made in the visual engineering of SSX in light of the PS2 architecture. Hopefully you can get some ideas for your own projects from this presentation. Once again, I'm going to be covering rendering techniques for SSX. In many cases, I'm going to talk about what we did for SSX and how we may have changed that implementation for SSX Tricky. I'm going to cover our character rendering, our facial animation, our terrain system, and our world lighting model. I'll briefly go over pipelines to talk about their importance in the visual engineering of any game. And finally, I'm going to talk about some of the things that other titles are doing, titles that are out now and ones that are in development, not at EA, but things that PS2 developers should be working on to really differentiate themselves from first-generation PS2 titles. So this slide shows generally the main components of the PS2 from a rendering standpoint. There's the EE core, or a motion engine, the main processing, the main processor of the PS2. There are two vector units. Each vector unit is 128 bits that work on four 32-bit floating-point operands simultaneously. There's the GS, or the graphic synthesizer. There's main memory of 32 megabytes and a DMA controller, which is essential for getting data through the system. Each vector unit has local data and instruction memory. The VU0 has 4K, the VU1 has 16K. They don't have, especially in the case of the VU1, direct access to main memory. So any programs you want to run on it have to be loaded. Any data that you need to process on those processors needs to be DMA'd to them. The PS2 does not provide a fixed transform and lighting engine. So for developing games for the PS2, you have to write your own. So BU1 is generally used as a TNL engine. As you can see, it's directly connected to the GS, whereas the BU0 is tightly coupled with the EE core. Most games use a BU1. You can use BU0 and EE core as well for geometry processing. So in order to create efficient games for the PS2, you need to get all these processors, all the caches on the system, to work in harmony. And maximizing the parallelism of the system is key to getting the most efficient rendering out of your game. So the big difference between first and second generation PS2 titles will stem from really understanding this architecture and how to maximize it. Most of the titles that launched on the PS2 were not really maxing out this system. So, our character models. For SSX, we used a skeleton system for animating our characters. A skeleton is made up of bones. Each bone has a position and orientation in space relative to the other bones in a skeleton hierarchy. The vertices of the model are connected to skeleton bones. Vertices move relative to the bone or bones that they are weighted to. The same skeleton can drive different models. The animation is stored independently to the model data. Therefore, animation can be shared among different models. This would not be the case with, say, keyframe animation, where you will store a unique model for each frame in your animation. Skeleton-based models are not as fast to render as static models, like keyframe models. However, they have a smaller data footprint when compared to keyframes, especially when you're dealing with lots of animation. Skeleton animation tends to be highly compressible due to its high frequency insensitivity and other compression techniques you can use on the data. SSX Tricky, for instance, used curve fitting to map animation data to linear, quadratic, and cubic polynomials, giving us, on average, about a 6-to-1 compression. So here you can see the skeleton we used in SSX Tricky with some robot animation playing on it. The main skeleton has 19 bones. There are 6 extra bones that are used for model-specific animation. So in this case, the extra bones are used to drive the eyes and the hair of the model. In other models, extra bones would be used for things like backpack or hair or whatever the animators need. So we used a skeleton-based system for both SSX and SSX Tricky. We had 25 active bones in the skeleton. The animation stored 19 common bones plus a collection of extra bones, of which 6 were activated for a given model. We basically filtered bones at runtime based on the target model's bone mappings. SSX used 2,500 polygons for their high-res model. SSX Tricky, we upped that to 3,000. We used 3 levels of detail for our models, 3,000, 1,500, and 750 for the low-res model. And we had up to 6 models on screen at a time. The system we implemented was different on SSX and SSX Tricky. So first I'll talk about SSX. We used a post-transform weighting system. Our skeleton defined a mapping from bone space to animated character space. Our vertices were stored in bone space. This actually causes data bloat due to the fact that if a vertex is weighted to multiple bones, then we store that vertex in multiple bone spaces. In fact, you could store the model vertices in a default character pose space and then modify the skeleton matrices after animation and physics processing to transform from default character pose space to animated character space. This would be done by storing out the inverse transforms from bone space to default character pose space and applying them to the final skeleton just once before transforming the vertices from pose space. So As you can see here, the pre-weighted vertex is stored in the bone space of each bone involved in the weighting operation. The weights applied to each bone must add up to 100%. So the implementation of this on the PS2, because we're only working with 25 bones, we sent those 25 bones up into BU1 memory space after they'd been animated. We then sent batches of bone space vertices with weighting information and index triangle strips to render the weighted geometry. For efficiency, we did not weight the per vertex normals for our lighting. We simply chose the dominant bone and transformed the normal using that bone. The resultant normal is, of course, not correct. As you can imagine, the more weighting that is applied to the model, the worse the lighting artifacts may become. However, we found that the lighting did not suffer very much from this optimization. We used double buffering for the VU1 microprogram layout. There are two input buffers. There are two output buffers. For the input buffers, the DMA feeds those input buffers with raw geometry data. The output buffers are sent from the VU1 memory space to the GS. The VU1 program that processes each batch of data synchronizes the switching of the input buffers. So this is pretty much the standard way to use VU1 to optimize for parallelism. Most games you do this. As you can imagine, the speed of the VU1 program, the speed of the GS, and the size of the DMA transfers must be tuned and balanced to minimize stalls. If this is set up properly, you should be DMAing data while the GS is rendering and while the VU1 program is working on the next set of data, all simultaneously. So for this system, the speed is about 7 million polygons per second, with an average of 10 vertices per strip. The strip efficiency is a big factor in this kind of system. In the average case, we transferred 1.25 vertices per triangle. Due to the indexing that we used, it would be a little bit less than 1.25. With dynamic lighting, it slows down considerably. For our lighting, we used three-directional plus one ambient light per vertex. So for SSX Tricky, we used a different system. We used blended matrices, or pre-transform weighting, as opposed to post-transform weighting. To do this, you generate blended matrices every frame from your base skeleton. These matrices are weighted to multiple bones. When you render the model, you transform each vertex with the blended matrix that contains the weighting that that vertex requires. So the main goal here is there's no post-transform weighting involved, so the actual VU1 code to render the data is much faster. So to do this, you generally have to create a lot of matrices. So in order to minimize the number of weighting combinations, we quantize the weighting. So we'd round the weighting to, say, the nearest 10% or 15%. We found that 10% or less was not really noticeable. The greater the quantizing, the less matrices we had to generate. So it's something you have to tune for each model based on what type of model you're weighting. Blended matrices work really well as a cross-platform approach. The GameCube, for example, has limited support for post-transform vertex operations. So it does, however, support index matrix transforms per vertex. So a system like this works quite well on the GameCube. For the Xbox, you know, you could use either system. Here you can see that we're storing our vertices in default character pose space as opposed to bone space, and our matrix transforms our vertices from pose space to world space. We apply the weights to our animated skeleton matrices to create the blended matrices. Those matrices transform from character pose space to world space. And at runtime, all we have to do is transform the vertex once by the appropriate blended matrix. So the implementation of this system. So we generated all the blended matrices on the CPU with the assistance of the vector unit zero. We found that the cost of doing this for 6 models was quite low, you know, under 3%. We quantized the weighting between 10 and 25%, depending on the level of detail that the model would be displayed at runtime. We limited the number of bones involved in the weighting to 3 bones. 3 bones is pretty good. You know, for things like shoulders, you'll need 3 bones to get the weighting to look properly. If you use less, you'll probably see some problems. If you use more, it's really dependent on what type of geometry you're weighting. So in total, on average per model, the high-res model, 250 matrices were generated, 150 for our medium-res, and 75 for our low-res model. The matrices, we can't fit all these matrices in VU1 memory, so what we do is we group them into batches, send them up to VU1. For each set of matrices, we send batches of vertices with matrix indices for transforming. Now, because we have these blended matrices already generated, we can transform our normals by the appropriate matrix and get the proper normal, weighted normal out of the system. So as a result, the lighting is more accurate with this system than it was with the optimization we did on the post-transform weighting. We rendered non-index strips. You could use index strips or non-index strips. It really depends on the data you're generating and the size of your vertex pool, you know, the cost of doing the indexing over the savings from doing less transforms. Once again, we used a double buffer VU1 architecture. So the performance for this system was faster at 9.6 with RGB lighting and 5.4 with the dynamic lighting. Let it load up. So here's the same animation that I showed earlier applied to Eddie, which is one of the characters in SSX Tricky. You can really see the weighting around the shoulders on this model. You can also see some facial animation. So there are lots of different ways of doing facial animation. For SSX and SSX Tricky, we use 2 different systems. For the original SSX, we used translational information only. It's a bones-based solution, and basically what you're doing is you're weighting face vertices to a hierarchy of bones, just like we did with the original SSX character rendering. Depending on what you need to do, this may require a lot of bones and a lot of vertex weighting. Because this kind of facial animation is essentially post-transform weighting, you still have to do all the work, even if the facial animation pose is frozen in one position. So unless you have a static model to represent your face when it's frozen, you know, you still have to do all the transformations. Bones are fairly constrained in the fact that your bone mapping or your original bone layout for the face constrains the kind of vertex animation you can achieve. The best case, of course, would be 1 bone per vertex, but if you needed that much flexibility, you'd want something like morph targets. For morph targets, you store multiple versions of the face geometry and blend combinations of those targets together at runtime. There are no bones involved. The animators can do whatever they like with the vertices of each target, so there's no constraints on a given target. Depending on how you implement morph targets or blend shapes, you can get some performance back from a static pose. So if you generate the morph target vertices in main memory, then you can cache the vertices, and you don't have to do any of the work if the facial animation is not changing. However, in order to avoid pipeline stalls, if you're working on the CPU, you're going to need to double or even triple buffer your work vertices. So the choice between morph vertices or translational null bones is not really that easy to make. Morph data has a very large initial memory cost to store the morph targets and the work buffers. However, it has a lower data overhead per animation and is potentially faster during runtime. Morph targets are easy to implement in a cross-platform manner and can be turned on and off when desired. So here's the morph targets for one of the characters in Tricky, Simon. There are 23 morph targets. What we have is morph targets for mapping facial phonemes and certain things like raising eyebrows and blinking the eyes. Here's going through each morph target. At runtime, we'll blend multiple morph targets together to generate the final image. So if we're doing lip syncing or things like that, we'll blend multiple targets together. For our characters, we used a simple directional lighting model. One ambient plus three directional lights affected the character model. The directional lights were derived from the center point of the model and the point and spotlights that make up the scene. This is a pretty big hack, but the performance was the main factor. It's an okay approximation, but it really isn't that much harder to do the full point and spotlight calculations in the VU1. The main reason we decided to go this way was for performance. In SSX Tricky, we had a second pass on our player model for specular components. So for shadows, all our characters in the game cast shadows. We used a fairly standard technique that I'm sure most people know about. A low-resolution version of the model is rendered into an off-screen texture from the point of view of the light. A projection volume is used to determine what geometry in the scene the shadow will potentially touch. A projection matrix is used to turn world coordinates into shadow texture coordinates. An extra rendering pass is applied to the train patches that intersect the projection volume. So here's a picture of that. In the top left, you can see the shadow texture that's generated, 2D texture. In the game, it's projected onto the curved surfaces. So a technique like this could be projected onto, you know, objects or really anything. It's not very good for self-shadowing, but it is a very efficient way of doing shadows, and it's completely cross-platform. This is a fairly hard-edged shadow. You can create softer-edged shadows with this technique if you, say, create a mipmap hierarchy and play with the trilinear filtering to get a soft edge. So for the train system in SSX, we used a curve net of bicubic Bezier patches. Bicubic Bezier patches are basically a high-order surface representation for the train. So So instead of storing raw geometry, we store the control points of a Bezier patch. So it gives us really good, it gave us very good compression over storing raw geometry. Our physics system intersects against the Bezier representation as opposed to polygonal facets. As a result, the intersection is much smoother and we don't have to filter the intersection data as much. We tessellate the patches to different levels of detail. The main point here is that we draw detail only where it's required and get performance back at the same time by rendering less polygons. So some of the disadvantages of using a higher order surface representation is you have to tessellate the geometry before you render it. So you have to turn those control points into vertex data. So it's not as fast as raw geometry if you do that tessellation every frame. However, if you do that tessellation on the main CPU or in main RAM and cache it, you can get near static geometry performance. So there's seeming issues with using LOD on Bezier patches. We use a system that I'll discuss shortly to get around this problem. Because the vertex data is generated from the Bezier representation, low-level vertex manipulation is not possible. This is fine if you want to model smooth surfaces, as we generally do in SSX. However, it is a trade-off to consider. There are other things that I'm sure you could do with a system like this, especially with future hardware on the PC, like deformation maps on top of your Bezier representation. So a real quick overview of bicubic Bezier patches. It's a high-order surface parametric representation. Surface is a function of three bivariate functions. Basically, those functions represent x, y, z in three space, and there are two parameters, parametric parameters between 0 and 1. As you iterate between 0 and 1, you sweep out the curve. Bezier patches are generally represented by control points and Bezier functions, a little bit more of an intuitive representation. For Beziers, the basis functions are called Bernstein polynomials. If you were using, say, Hermite curves or some other type of representation, those blending functions would be different. The control points are what we call the characteristic polyhedron. You see that on the bottom left there. It's sort of the, you know, high-order grid that controls the surface. And on the right, you see a tessellation of that Bezier patch. The Bezier can be represented with a matrix notation, which is very friendly for vertex or vector processing. And this is what we use for SSX. So for a level of detail, to solve this problem, we applied a simple distance heuristic for each of the four boundary edges that make up the patch. Based on that heuristic, we classify an edge as requiring, in our case, 4, 6, or 8 vertices. If all the edges are the same, then we use a uniform tessellation on that patch. If any of them are different, we use non-uniform tessellation. A glue patch. Because the heuristic only looks at the boundary curves of the patch, all that's required is C0 continuity. So we don't have to store connectivity information between the different patches. Basically, the neighboring patches must share control points along the boundary edge connecting them. I have a brief white paper in the proceedings that you can look at, which goes into more detail. So here's a non-uniform patch, non-uniform mesh. Here you can see the four glue strips and a uniform inner mesh. So the glue strips ensure that the number of vertices on the edge match what the heuristic wants. The inner mesh glues those together. Now, there are some hardware-based implementations to this on other platforms, something similar to this. Most of those do something slightly different. You could do it with two glue strips and just a larger mesh connecting it. We found that using a uniform inner mesh that was closest to our high-res mesh made that ensured that the surface topology didn't pop as much when it switched LED. So, gee, I don't know if you can make all that out. Here's a typical scene from SSX shown as line strips with 4x4 tessellation. There are approximately 500 patches in this example. SSX had up to 1,000 or more patches on screen at a time. Here's that same scene with 6x6. Does that look green to everyone? That's just me. And here it is at 8x8. And finally, with the LED on. So, as you can see, the patches near the camera are 8x8, so it's just a simple distance-based heuristic. The mid-ground are 6x6, and the far patches are 4x4. The black patches are glue strips that seam together the different LEDs. So here's the train without lighting. And the image is very similar to as if it was all rendered with the highest resolution patches. So in implementing this, we did all our tessellation on the VU1. So we decided not to cache the vertices. The main reason for this was the VU1 is actually very fast at using direct evaluation to evaluate the Bezier patch. You could use forward differencing, recursive subdivision, or various other methods to evaluate the Bezier patch. But for the VU1, a direct evaluation is the fastest. It works out, the inner loop works out to about 4 cycles per vertex. Once again, we used a double buffered layout. We knew the stepping at which we were going to evaluate our patch, so we pre-calculate blending tables and put them up in VU1 so we can speed things up. We had special case code with unrolled loops for uniform tessellation and special code for dealing with the non-uniform case. For each patch, we generate 2 sets of UVs or more, one for the base texture, another set for light maps, and up to 6 others for character shadows. So with the heuristic we're using, we found that a typical scene was about 77% 4x4s, 14% 6x6, 3% 8x8, and 6% non-uniform. So the average number of polygons per patch is about 30. So when we first did this, we profiled this at about 6 million polygons per second. If we did this without LOD, now we could tessellate to 8x8 or just store static geometry. If we rendered everything in 8x8, then we'd have 98 polygons per patch. So it would require 330% more polygons to render the same scene. So a static implementation or a tessellated implementation would have to, requires almost 20 million polygons per second to get the same performance. Now this is, definitely possible on the PS2 to get this performance with static geometry. However, we found for SSX that a track with, say, 10,000 patches would be over 15 megabytes as raw data versus about 1.5 megs with control points. So memory is a big issue. So our world lighting, we represent it with ambient, single directional, and lots of points of spotlights. As I said earlier, for our characters, we use an abstraction of those point and spotlights to generate directional lights. We also use negative lighting for shadows. basically, this is just a simple trick of having lights that subtract from the lighting equation. It's a very simple way to model dynamic shadows. It's been used in, you know, the film media for a long time. Most packages support it. For a train, we pre-calculated our lighting using light maps. So each patch is evaluated as a grid of points. The resolution of that grid is the resolution of the light map we want to create. Because we're doing our lighting offline, we can use any lighting model we like to generate that data. So the full lighting equation for each sample point, the resultant colors are stored in a 2D texture that represents the projection of that lighting onto the surface. So for SSX, we use 8x8 or 16x16 resolution light maps. If you're doing level of detail and your geometry is going to be moving around or popping or changing, and if you're using a vertex lighting model, then that lighting information is going to move around and pop. So one of the advantages of using light maps is you decouple your lighting resolution from your geometric resolution. So you don't have to concern yourself with those issues. So I'm sure most of you know all about light maps. But here's just a simple representation. A base texture, a color light map. You scale that up with point sample. It doesn't look that great. So you really need to depend on the bilinear filtering of the hardware to smooth out that lighting. So that's why the light maps are generally stored at fairly low resolution, and you still get good quality lighting. You use the final light map and the base texture. You use a source times destination color modulate, and you get the final lighting. So doing colored light maps on the PS2 is not as easy as one would like. When the Sony engineers designed the PS2, they decided not to support source times destination color modulate. So as a result, you have to do a few tricks. So this blending method is supported, destination minus source times alpha. So this is the blending mode that we used. Basically, we take our 24-bit light map and we're going to convert it to a 32-bit light map to do this. So we set these two equal to each other. Here's what we want on the left, and this is what we're going to use on the right. However, we have more unknowns than we have equations here, so we have to make some assumptions. So the first one is we decide to store the alpha channel as the luminosity of the light map. So in this case, we're just using the maximum of the red and green and blue channel. This is, you know, fairly intuitive in the sense that the modulation of the lighting information, pulling out the luminosity, seems to make sense. We need to solve for our new color component of the light map. So we do this. However, we know CL, we know AS, but we don't know CD. However, if you make the assumption that each light map is unique and each light map is projected onto one base texture in the game, or projection of that texture, then we really do know what CD is offline as we're creating these in our pipeline. So here's an example. We know the base texture that this light map is going to be projected on, so we scale it down to the resolution of our light map, and that becomes our new CD sampling. From the CL color light map, we can generate AS directly. From CD, CL, and AS, we can drive CS. So I've shown those scaled up, and you can see the luminosity information and the colored light map. You can see that the colors are actually the complementary version of the original light map, and you can see details of the original base texture in that light map. So when you apply that blending mode, the results are pretty much the same. Now, this is not definitely not perfect, because there is error introduced, and it's a function of the resolution of our light map compared to the base projection and the sampling of that CD texture. it's not really very noticeable. We found that if there's a very high contrast base texture, then you will see a little bit of color bleeding, but it's pretty acceptable. One of the disadvantages of this system is, well, you have a 32-bit light map instead of a 24-bit light map. And if you want to do any dynamic lighting or caching your light maps and updating them, you have to solve this problem, you know, in real time. So here's that same picture without lighting, and here it is with light maps. So our object rendering, for SSX and for Tricky, all of our objects were dynamically lit, as opposed to pre-calculating our lighting. We mainly chose this because we had a lot of instance models, and we didn't want to store the data for every single instance of pre-calculated lighting information. So instead, we just stored the normals of a base model and then just transform it around the world. So this is a pretty big trade-off. As a result, our lighting model is the same as our character model lighting, one ambient plus three directional lights. So we use a light directional matrix and a color matrix. The data has positional normals and texture coordinates in PS2 compressed format. And each instance has an object matrix that has scaling and transformation information. So this is pretty much the PlayStation 1 lighting model, basically, for dynamic lighting. And it's basically a memory versus quality trade-off. So there are better methods. One is, you know, pre-calculate the RGBs for these models. Once again, it's just finding the memory for it. If you pre-calculate your lighting, then your code for rendering it will actually be a lot simpler and a lot faster. If you pre-calculate your lighting for those objects that do need dynamic lighting, you now have the cycles free to do proper point and spotlights. So there's a completed scene with a character, shadow, same terrain. You can see a few objects and parts of our particle system there. So I'm just going to talk about pipelines in general real quickly. Reason is generally pipelines are not given enough importance in video games. I mean, there are some developers out there who realize how important the pipeline is, but in most development schedules, the resources put against what goes on in the tools that come into the game are less than the actual, you know, runtime components themselves. Your pipeline is your artist's interface for creating content for the game. So whatever tools they have need to be powerful. They need to be quick. Your pipeline also generates your data for your game. So this is your opportunity to process your data, optimize your data. You know, if your runtime is given, you know, unoptimized data, there's really not much that your game engine can do with it. So for SSX and Tricky, we used an off-the-shelf package as opposed to creating our own world editing system. This is, you know, a choice that every developer needs to make based on what sort of game they're making. The packages that are out there today are really powerful, and the artists are generally already familiar with them, and they're very customizable. However, using a package, you generally have to either modify the package to match what you're doing in the game, or you have to adopt some of the models that that package is using. So, for example, the lighting models of that package. The whole idea is if the artist is working on something within this package, and it looks and behaves the way it does in the game, then they don't have to always process their data to actually see what it's going to look like in the game. One of the things that we tried to do in SSX was give as much control to our artists as possible. So giving them full control over the lighting of the scene, where the cameras go, animation data, etc. This is really important to give your artists as much control as possible. You might be tempted to, you know, hard code a lot of things or do programmer-based intervention to create some effects or tweaking of visual elements. But your artists will generate superior results if given the right tools to generate them. You know, in the final estimate, it's the game itself that's going to show you exactly what it's going to look like. So if your artists are iterating their data, they need to see it in game. They need to see it quickly. So ideally, this is an instantaneous thing. However, the faster and you can make your pipeline for previewing data, the better. So once again, pipelines, pre-process everything you can. Chances are, for any game, you're doing things in your runtime that can probably be offloaded to as a pre-process into your pipeline. So obvious things like data optimization, triangle strips, etc., data compression, lighting. If you can do static lighting or pre-process lighting, then this is a huge opportunity for quality improvement. Visibility, scene sorting, organizing your world. Lots of games out there still do simple view frustum culling for their runtime. There's lots of different things you can do. So, for PS2 games that are in development now, or for games that some games that are out there, you know, they do these things, but really, making second or third generation PS2 titles is really tied to the hardware. Basically, you know, better balancing of the system, understanding all the different components, the parallel nature of the PS2, and optimizing for it is really key to getting the most performance. So data management, understanding what's going on with your DMA, the performance. iCache and dcache is a big performance bottleneck on the PS2. At least we found that on our title. So you need to recognize this and optimize for it. Texture management on the PS2, there's lots of hidden costs in page hits and accessing across pages. You could optimize for this by breaking up your textures to fit within pages, or using MIT mapping, bilinear as opposed to trilinear maybe, so that the number of page hits you're getting is less. Using Path3 for texture uploading. This was kind of tricky for first generation titles, but it's now a very solved problem, and there's lots of information for that on the Sony website. This lets you, you know, optimize your stalls in Path 1, Path 2, to speed up your architecture. Sony now has a performance analyzer that, you can go to one of their offices, I don't know which offices have them, and take your game in, and they'll analyze it, and you can get a lot of information for your game. So if you're doing a PS2 title, it's definitely well worth contacting them to see if you can analyze for the bottlenecks in your game. VU zero usage, I say this just because generally the VU zero, at least in a lot of games, is underutilized. Look for things that you're doing in the EE core and the CPU that could be transferred onto the VU zero. So on the PS2, limited amount of RAM, you have to make a lot of trade-offs. Memory versus speed is one of the biggest ones. So it's, a classic computer science problem. So if you can get more speed back or higher quality from memory by using more memory, then this leads to, streaming your worlds. Obviously it's not for every game, but I think for games like you know, that have large worlds, this is definitely the direction. And there's some titles out there already doing this. So I put this up here basically to say that I think for the PS2 that broadcast quality is something that we should aim for. I'm not saying we'll necessarily get it. Now, when I say broadcast quality, I don't necessarily mean, you know, photorealism. I'm really talking about production value. So there's lots of things that you can do on the PS2 to take away the CG edge of your game, to make it look a little bit more realistic, a little less CG. So, you know, PS2, a lot of the launch titles suffered from interlace flicker problems. This is a solved problem. Just go to the Sony developers' website. There are ways of doing it. Most titles are doing it now, but, you know, everyone should. Anti-aliasing, not necessarily as important as the interlace flicker problem, but there are ways of doing this, and depending on, you know, the fill rate of your title, it's definitely something to look at. There are very few games out there that model cameras accurately. Well, probably none. But there are lots of things you can do. Depth of field is another one of those effects that you can do on the PS2. And depending on your game, it might be something worth looking into. Better lighting, I think, you know, all the titles coming out for the PS2, second, third generation titles, things like, you know, using global illumination, radiosity, irradiance lighting, things like this you should be looking into. Soft shadows, there are lots of ways of doing soft shadows. Most games out there, including SSX, didn't use soft shadows. There are ways of doing this, and if you have shadows in your game. Occlusion systems. For games that are very big, that have lots of data, there's really no point if your inner loop has got like 10 cycles per vertex if you're drawing 10 times more than you can see. There's lots of games, you know, obviously, you know, in the PC arena going back years, you know, people have been using occlusion systems, pre-calculated visibility sets, runtime occlusion systems. In the console world, there aren't as many titles out there that using occlusion systems that should. So it's something, you know, if your game has a very large environment with lots of geometry, you should look into some type of occlusion system. So here's some references I put up here. These are, you know, some books that I reference quite often and I found useful when doing research for SSX. I also have the PS2 developer website up there. It's a secure website, but, you know, if you're doing PS2 development, you should really go over that site. I'm done. Go ahead. We use Maya. Oh, sorry. The question was, what tools were used for train building and creating light maps? We use Maya for creating our world geometry. For light maps, we created them from the lighting information in Maya in our pipeline. So we created the light maps ourselves. Yes?
Can you talk a little bit about how your choice of your frame representation and your art pipeline affected like the creative part of creating the tracks of the gameplay?
Sure. So the question is, how did the choice of using higher order surfaces affect the art process, and how did that affect the gameplay? So originally we were not using higher order surfaces. In fact, we were using just raw geometry. We originally decided to use Bezier for our physics, actually, and to get the smooth intersection. Then we decided, well, hey, let's try using that for rendering as well. For our artists, It was a big change from having low-level vertex control. So you need a really good package for manipulating, you know, NURBS surfaces or, you know, Bezier patches. So it took a while to people to switch over, but, you know, you need a good technical artist to understand the, you know, the implications of setting those up, dealing with issues like control point snapping, processing your data. So yeah. The artists work with the production staff in defining moments, building up the level, and very much so. The artists would actually be play testing the track as they develop it. There's actually another talk going on this afternoon by Sunisha Karalik, who worked on SSX, on the track process for SSX. So definitely check that out. Yes. Yes. Basically what we do is we have our fixed skeleton of 25 bones. We'd animate those bones to create our final set. Now, in the earlier system, we would just send those directly to the rendering system. At that point, we take those bones, we transform them by a preset of 25 bones that will transform from character space to bone space. So as a result, we get a final set that goes from character space to, you know, world space. We take those 25, we take the weighting information that we know we need to generate, and from those 25 matrices, we create all the other matrices. We then group them into a batch grouping that we figure out offline and send those up to the VU1. Those matrices, you know, would be used for both the lighting and the vertex transformation. Yes. Yes, exactly. Yes. So the question is, do we export from Maya polygonal data as well as, you know, terrain-based data? Basically, all the data we have in our track goes from Maya. So all the object geometry, all the patches, all the lights, animation, textures, pretty much everything. We don't touch the data except to optimize it after it comes out of the package. So we have a custom exporter to filter that data out. Yes?
My question was, are the buildings polygonal or are they done with curves?
Oh, well, the buildings, the question is, are the buildings polygonal or curved surfaces? They're polygonal. We could use curved surfaces, but we didn't. Different engine. So an optimized engine for rendering objects, you know, static geometry, vertex lighting versus the light map approach. Yes. Right. So the question is, could I elaborate on the tools that we use for quick artist preview and for viewing the data in game? So basically, we design our pipeline to turn off certain modes so that they could process the track very quickly. You know, there's a lot of caching going on in the pipeline to ensure that we don't have to necessarily process all the data for an update. So we worked on designing that so it would be very quickly. Now, it certainly wasn't perfect by any means. You know, a full track still took, five minutes, let's say, to process. So the artists will have these tools available to them. They have a development system in front of them, so they can view their, you know, their work in the package, but they can also at any time process it and view it in the game and play test it. So usually what they're doing is they're working on a subset. So if they're tuning gameplay, they'll probably say turn off the light maps, you know, not export the objects, just the train to get, you know, to balance all that, that feeling. So there wasn't a dev kit per artist. We, they would share them as groups, you know, being that they're networked. And so, yeah, about 4 artists per dev machine. Okay. Well, if you have any other questions, you know, feel free to come up to the front. Thank you.